Maine's Commissioner of Defense, Veterans, and Emergency Management, Major General Douglas Farna. About 3,000 Mainers serve in the Maine Army or Air National Guard. Major General Douglas Farnham oversees all of them. And that's not all. He's also responsible for the Maine Emergency Management Agency and overseeing veteran services here in a state where 1 in 10 people is a veteran. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we talk with General Farnham about Maine's safety and security, its services to veterans, and the role of the National Guard. How does one plan for everything from a potential forest fire to a cyber attack? How is the mission of the Guard changing with modern times? And how is the state doing in its effort to find every homeless veteran a home? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Three critical areas for our state fall under one department: defense, veterans, and emergency management. Today we talk with the head of that department. Joining me in the studio, Major General Douglas Farnham. He has served as commissioner of the Department of Defense, Veterans, and Emergency Management since 2016 and was reappointed by Governor Mills in 2019. He also serves as the adjutant general of the Maine National Guard. General Farnham is a pilot who joined the Maine Air National Guard in 1991 and commanded the 101st Air Refueling Wing in the Maine National Guard. As always, we want to hear from you. Are there veterans issues you're concerned about? Emergency preparedness you'd like to talk about? You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. General Farnham, welcome to the Maine Calling studio. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Well, it's great to be here. It's always good to talk about the great folks that work in our department.
I'd like to start by talking about the Maine National Guard. I understand that 69 members of the 286 Combat Sustainment Support Battalion are currently deployed in Poland and have been there for about 9 months now. What can you tell me about what they're doing there and when they'll return?
Okay. Well, right now, I think they're preparing to come home and probably pretty anxious. We're hoping next month that they start to head back this way. What they're really doing in Powitz, Poland, is part of a U.S. presence that over there in the Baltics and in that region, just basically show force and to practice, with the NATO partners, interoperability, and just to make sure that that we are ready and ready when time comes, and actually maybe showing a little deterrence at the same time.
And you got to go over and see them.
I went over at Thanksgiving, and it was absolutely outstanding to see them over there, see where they were working. And it was Thanksgiving Day, so to be with them, it was great. And I got a chance to hit a little flag football tournament for the Thanksgiving, so they brought a little home over there with them, and I got to cheer them on, and they were too fast and young for me to play with them, but it was good.
Is what they've been doing day-to-day with NATO troops, with soldiers from other countries?
Mostly it's been with U.S. folks, but working a lot with the local Polish troops and yes, some NATO troops, but mainly coordinating a lot of the logistics in that region of Europe.
All right. It's been reported that another unit out of Brewer might be deployed to Africa. Is that still the case, that they're preparing for a possible deployment?
It's still the case. They're working in that direction. I don't think we have the final word on timing yet, but it's a little ways in the future. But they're getting ready.
I know that these units really never know, but sometimes are given a bit of a heads up. Is that it? Are you pretty confident that no other units will be deployed soon?
That's all we know of it at this point. We did have one other unit that was a rumor about, and that got called off, which sometimes that's as hard when they call off these deployments as when you add in a deployment, because people make plans to be gone, employers make plans, and so getting off-ramped, what they call it, it can be very, very difficult.
You know, I know that a few years ago when the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan were really, at full personnel, there was a huge surge in the number of National Guard units that were called into active duty. Do you believe that that has peaked and that we're going to go back to the way it used to be? Or do you think that these wars have changed the role of the Guard and that the Guard is going to continue to be called up much more often than it used to be?
There's no question that it has changed the way the country looks at the Guard. You know, we use the term operational reserve versus a strategic reserve that we all thought of for years and years. And by being an operational reserve, it just forces us to be at a level that is more ready, more likely to be used. But it's also the expectation of our airmen and soldiers is that they're going to be used more often. And so right now, finding the right balance is what we try to do. And nationally, what we are working on is saying, hey, what is the right amount to use the Guard, and so that we're not overusing it, but that they maintain that situation where they're an operational reserve and they're ready to go.
How does that affect recruitment or what you say to the young people who join the Guard? Is the message that you're giving them different than it was maybe 20 years ago?
Oh, absolutely. The one weekend a month is not something that we can talk about quite so much, because it can be a lot more than that. At the same time, people come in with the right expectation, and they want to deploy. They're not joining the Guard. The kids that are joining the Guard are not joining the Guard to, you know, sit around and not do anything. So sometimes it's as big a challenge is meeting that expectation. They want to go do something, and if we can't find a deployment for them and we can't get good, deployments for training or actual deployments, they get bored and leave, and that's not what we like to see either.
I know that it's the law that employers must make space for Guard members to train and deploy if possible, but there are always news stories about difficulty when Guard members return, and this is nationally. What about here in Maine? How are Maine employers?
Maine employers have been incredibly supportive. And the stories that we hear over and over again, is that they go well above what the would be expected to support Guard service. Now, that said, it's been 16 years, and so, or actually 19 years now, that we've been using a Guard at a pretty regular pace. So, there have been, there are times I think employers are strained a little bit. They want to do the right thing, and that's why the organizations like Employer Support of the Guard and Reserve and even our own programs and trying to outreach and make sure that we're able to tell the story so they know what their employees are doing when they're in uniform and know the value that it brings back to them when they are back on the job.
What is the Employer Support Guard and Reserve? I don't know that program.
Employer Support of the Guard and Reserve is a great organization made up mostly volunteers in the state that serve two purposes, really. One is to be outreach to the employers to let them know, what the Guard is doing and the reserves are doing, and to coordinate and to educate the guardsmen is what their responsibilities are toward the employers. And so it's really they advocate and educate for how that relationship between the guardsmen and the employers works.
A couple of years ago, when you were speaking before the legislature, you were talking about some of the issues facing the Guard and talked about the difficulty in recruitment. Tell me, does that challenge continue? What are you seeing out there when you're trying to attract young people?
Right. It is. Recruiting and retention, but recruiting is a big part of, is one of our primary focuses in both the Air and Army Guard going forward. It continues to be a challenge. It continues to be a challenge all over the country, particularly in the Northeast and regionally other parts of the country, where we're not, I don't think we're recruiting proportionally the numbers that they do, especially in the South and the West. And I can't explain that completely. There's no question that Maine has some specific challenges with a reduced number of kids of that age that are out there in the pool.
And when you say kids, you mean under 35, right?
Under 35, under 40. They changed the numbers a little bit. But really, you go to I live up in Bangor, and the number of Little League teams, almost half of what they had, just 15 years ago. The schools, most classes are smaller in a lot of parts of Maine. So there's just less recruiting age kids out there.
And how about the readiness of the recruiting age young people that are out there?
Well, that's the other factor. A lot the number that gets thrown around, that 70% of the folks that are of the right age aren't eligible for a variety of reasons, you know, run-ins with, you know, the law, drug use, medical, obesity is the one that really, you know, that I shake my head at when I think that the number of kids just from like 1991 until the mid-2000s that are overweight and too overweight to serve has almost doubled. And I said, geez, that's during the time I was raising my kids. Have we really, as a society, got to that level in that time frame? It's a little shocking, but that is one of the challenges. Medical issues, we are very quick now to, you know, prescribe medication that ends up, you know, affecting ability to serve later on if we're not documenting and careful about doing those types of things.
How many positions are open? How many more Guard members would you hope to fill as soon as possible?
Oh, we're always recruiting because we're got guys retiring out the top all the time. So, you know, we are still in a place that we're better than some states as far as our spots that are full. You know, we run, you know, in the high mid-90s on the air side and, you know, pretty close to that on the Army side too, just a little bit below that on the Army side. But we used to have a waiting list in some cases, and that waiting list is pretty much gone.
All right. And one more question about the Guard before we move on. Do you feel confident that the Maine Army National Guard units and Air Guard units that are currently here in Maine will stay here, that there won't be any kind, that there's no kind of realignment on the horizon?
I feel relatively confident that the future is bright is the way that I say. I think that as, you know, right now the budget, the federal budget for the military has been, you know, high. And so that puts, you know, sometimes that works against us because they can afford to do a lot more things on the active duty. But when things get a little tighter, the Guard is an affordable way to defend the country. So at the end of the day, I'm usually pretty confident. We, you know, we focus all the time on do we have the right mix of units, and that so that sometimes changes. And again, as long as we can recruit and fill the positions that we have, then I'm relatively confident that we'll be okay force structure wise.
All right. Well, I want to move on. You're also in charge of veteran services. I understand that's really kind of ever expanding. A new office in Westbrook just this past year.
Right. The Veteran Services is an area that everybody wants to help, and everybody's very passionate about wanting to help veterans. And the state of Maine has been very generous in allowing us the resources to match all the private sector resources that are out there with the federal resources, and provide, you know, providing outreach to those veterans.
You were part of a group that, and it's an ongoing group that is not just here in Maine, but nationally, trying to reduce the number of homeless veterans to zero. Where are we now? How many homeless veterans do we believe there are? What kind of strides have been made in the 2 years that there's been such a intense focus on this issue?
Well, that's part of the problem. I'm sure there's statistics out there that will tell you the numbers, but one of the things that we find is it's really hard to pin down the actual number because a lot of them don't want to be found. They don't want to say, hey, I'm a veteran for a variety of reasons. So that's one of the reasons that has been such an emphasis. You know, homelessness isn't good for anybody, whether you're a veteran or not. And we're just fortunate that we've got the resources to go out and actually try to, you know, find our veterans that are homeless, and people are very generous in trying to help solve those problems.
All right. And I know that in the last few years, the identification and treatment for soldiers with post-traumatic stress has also been a really big and important focus, especially as Vietnam War veterans begin to retire and begin to have time on their hands. What kind of efforts are underway right now to reach them?
Well, our veteran services, that's one of the things that they focus on is that outreach. And so over the years, you know, they've done a lot of the traditional things. I think as we've added the resources, you know, a couple of years ago, legislature gave us a position that was responsible for outreach. So they've been able to go to some of the more, you know, going into the criminal justice arena, going into the corrections arena, going into the arts community, LGBTQ community, the tribal community, just the places that they haven't gone in and been able to really reach out for those veterans and try to find them, identify if there are any issues. We have to be careful when we start talking about all veterans are victims of some sort. I mean, that's not always the case. But if they do have needs, just trying to match them with the number of organizations that are out there, because there really are. One of the things that is so impressive in the state of Maine is the number of organizations and people that are out there that want to help veterans. And you can find some organization or some person that can help almost everybody.
All right. And another hat you've taken on since you've taken this job is that of Maine Emergency Management Agency. I can only imagine that's very different than your career as a pilot.
We tried to avoid the emergencies in the airplane, that is for sure. But it has been a learning experience dealing with emergency management. But in some ways, it's been great. It's been great because the people that work in emergency management, they want to be there. I mean, emergency management is something that you have a calling for. You're preparing and training and preparing and training day in, day out for something you hope will never happen. It takes a special person that's willing to do that, and the folks at Maine Emergency Management are no different.
How has the work of MEMA changed in this age of potential cyber attack? I mean, we used to be planning for ice storms, right, and floods, and maybe forest fires.
Well, that's exactly some of the, really since 9/11, you get into cyber, you get into some of the terrorism type aspects. Those are all, they add to the challenge. But from the perspective of emergency management, a lot of those things are so there's so many pieces to it, and you got Department of Homeland Security at the national federal level that are working on that stuff. Really, emergency management comes down to really the basics: is how do you respond to the result of whatever that is, whether it's a hurricane or a big fire or something that is man-made or cyber caused the problem. How do we respond to that, and how do we how do we prepare for it? How do we mitigate what could happen? And then how do we respond and recover if it does?
All right. Well, we're speaking with Major General Douglas Farnham. He is Commissioner for the Department of Defense, Veterans, and Emergency Management. We'd love to have you join the conversation. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. 1-800-399-3566. Our email address is talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
For the last decade or so, the world has been rocked by massive protest movements like the Arab Spring and Black Lives Matter. To some, they appeared disorganized, but does that mean they failed?
We talked about wages, we talked about the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer. Like, here we go.
I'm Elsa Chang. How Occupy Wall Street laid the foundation for today's politics, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And that's this evening at 4 here on Maine Public Radio. You are listening to Maine Public Radio's regular schedule stream. While on air, we are carrying live NPR coverage of the Senate impeachment trial. That will continue until 4 this afternoon, when All Things Considered will be on the air with the day's full news. Please note, if you'd like to watch the Senate impeachment trial, Maine Public Television, both the Maine and World channels, are offering coverage from the PBS NewsHour. And we have a visual stream on our website, mainepublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. My guest today, Major General Douglas Farnham, Commissioner of the Department of Defense, Veterans, and Emergency Management. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post a comment to our Facebook page. Joining us on the line now is Darren Woods. He is director of Aroostook County Emergency Management and fire chief of North Lakes Fire and Rescue. Thank you so much for calling in, Darren.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
I am guessing that the biggest emergency management issues you face in the county are weather. Am I right?
Yes. I want to say those are the top of our list, but it's not the only thing on our list.
What else is on the list?
Well, we've got technological hazards. We've got a number of facilities with hazardous materials that we are concerned with. as well as our dams that we have across Aroostook County and our large border that we have with Canada.
So what are your biggest concerns at this point about emergency management in the state of Maine?
So one of the big things that we are concerned with is the federal funding of emergency management grants. Those programs help to fund county and local programs and really keep communities and counties prepared for what if. Without those funds, these offices would really be cut way down, which are already understaffed. That would become a problem for us. So we look forward to the future, and we're trying to work with state and local and county budget managers so that we can make sure that there's a plan in place if the federal funds start dwindling now.
Have you been given notice that the federal funds may be dwindling?
No, but it's always on that radar, right? So we have been flat funded for a couple of years, and that kind of raises the awareness for us because costs continue to increase in every piece of every industry in the world right now. So it's something we have to be planning and preparing for.
So do you have a question for Commissioner Farnham in here in the studio with me?
Hey, General, how are you?
Good, Darren.
Good. So the one question that I have that the other counties are concerned with is the current vacancy of the director position of Maine Emergency Management. And so we're hoping that it's on the radar to be filled permanently soon. So while I say that, I'm going to caveat that with the current acting director, Peter Rogers, is doing a really good job, and we all have high confidence in him. So it's not a reflection on him. It's just that in his role as acting director, there are some national things that he can't address. So is that, do you think, on the radar to be settled pretty soon?
It is, Darren. It is absolutely on the radar, and I hope we'll have this taken care of soon, because I know the governor and I both think that emergency management is a critical function, and Pete is, you know, I agree, Pete's doing a great job as an acting role. He's been the acting role several times, and he's always done a great job. And while I'm talking, I'm going to say thanks for what you do and all the county emergency management folks and the other local emergency management folks. Folks that are listening may not realize, but one of the things I learned early on and as I got involved in emergency management is the phrase that all emergencies are local. And when something happens, we really count, and everybody counts on their local emergency managers, their local first responders. That's where it all begins. And then as they need additional resources, they start asking. And that's when, from the city, the county jumps in, and then they ask the state for help. And then we ask the federal government for help if we need it. So without a strong county emergency management program, we'd really struggle.
Darren, thanks so much for joining us today on Maine Calling. Darren Woods directs Aroostook County's Emergency Management. We'll go to Joy, who's calling from Belfast. Hi, Joy. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Thank you for letting me speak today. Good afternoon, General. How are you?
Good afternoon, Joy.
Yeah. I just wanted to call in because you've been so supportive of Honor Flight Maine, especially last June when we celebrated the D-Day commemoration at Camp Chamberlain. But I wanted to ask, if you had any suggestions for Honor Flight Maine regarding how we can better find our World War II veterans. You know, it's definitely a challenge for us. We have, the funding. Actually, we're going to do 5 trips this year to Washington, and it's free for our veterans to go. But the challenge is trying to find them because due to privacy concerns and everything, we're not going to get a list of names from any organization that we have come across at this point, but we're just trying to figure out, what other ways are possible potentially in Maine to try to find them.
That's a good question. I know you're pretty plugged into the veteran community, and if Bureau of Veteran Services, Dave Richmond and Melissa Ouellette and those folks, I would think could help you a little bit with the names they know. But, you know, I think one of the things that I love about Honorflight Maine is that you know, it's just a unique experience for those folks, really a special thing that everybody's doing. And getting the word out, I would think it's the family member. Knowing some of the World War II veterans that are out there, and where they are in their life, and just the way they carry themselves, and not always talking about their service for years and years, they're probably less likely to be the ones say, "Hey, I want to go do that." But the people that I've also heard from that it really means something to is the family member who may have heard about Honor Flight Maine, who said, "You know, I really want to get my parent on that trip because I know it would be special for them." And then I think it's really special for the family member to see their loved one that down there in DC and experiencing all that. So I guess my advice would be continue to, you know, do what you're doing as far as the outreach goes. I know the fundraiser you have on TV, a lot of people see and mention, and focus maybe on that family member that can convince their loved one that, hey, it's really something they ought to do while they still can.
Joy, thanks so much for calling in. Good luck to you. We're going to go on to one of your predecessors calling in, General Bill Libby. Hi, General Libby. How are you?
I'm well, Jennifer. How are you?
I'm great. Do you have a question for our guest today?
I do, and I know Doug thinks I was going to call in and talk to him about Maine hockey, but that's not the subject today. You know, Doug, it was frightening to hear you say it had been 19 years. I mean, it does not seem like 19 years. But back after 9/11, when we first started deploying units of the Maine Army and Air National Guard, we didn't have a family support program. And a family in Fryeburg, Maine, whose husband deployed with one of our units, would find themselves the only member of that community who had somebody gone with no support structure. And it didn't take long at the national level for a very robust family support program to develop and be funded. I'm kind of curious what the status of the family support program is now.
Well, thanks, General Libby. Thanks for calling. I appreciate the question. The family program is still pretty strong. I mean, it's one of those things that really, I think a lot of folks didn't realize how much it was needed until we had it. And now there are not too many people that don't advocate very strongly at the national level and also here in the state. And I think part of it is a recognition of, as we started deploying and we became more operational, we realized that we weren't the old guard where the local community armory had everybody in town, would be involved, and everybody knew everybody that was in the guard. And now as we've modernized and the units are designed and manned the way they are, you can end up with somebody in a small community that doesn't have a lot of that support structure around them. And so the family program became very, very important. And you just never hear people say that, hey, we're spending too much effort in that area. That it still, from my perspective, gets strong support. And the soldiers and airmen that work in the programs, there's not too many people that work. For instance, I know you were close to the summer youth camp, and there's very few airmen and soldiers that don't work there that don't come away talking about their experience working with that program the rest of their career.
Well, I have you both here, General Libby and General Farnham. Let me ask you a question. What makes a good Maine National Guard or Air Guard member? What are you looking for? General Libby, I'll start with you.
Well, that's a pretty simple question as far as I'm concerned. I mean, the qualities that young men and women have in Maine that we grow up with, just are key to being successful in any venture. It doesn't hurt. You mentioned 1 in 10. The number was higher some time back, being veterans in the state of Maine. We have a strong military tradition in the state of Maine. At one point in time, we were first or second in the nation as a measure of percentage of population in the number of veterans that we had. We don't tend to think of ourselves as having a strong military tradition, but we did. and we do. And those main values that we all grow up with are integral to being successful in either the Army or in National Guard or in any venture you pursue in life. So we found ourselves in a target-rich environment surrounded by great people. I do share some of Doug's concern. I'm a member of Mission Readiness, an organization that tries to tackle those issues that we're dealing with now of obesity and lack of education and police record that disqualifies so many of our young men and women right now. But for those who join, who come from Maine, who come from strong military backgrounds, they serve us well.
From my perspective, that strong tradition is something that helps us, because one of the biggest determining factors whether somebody's willing to serve and wants to serve is the fact, do they have family members that served? And where we have that high percentage, that has helped us. Now, the flip side of that is, as we, you know, the active duty is basically not, we don't have active duty in Maine anymore, the bases, as some of the numbers have drawn down, as time goes by, whether that propensity to serve will go down, because we don't have the people with the family members. And that's a little bit concerning. Why when I talk to veterans, sometimes I'll say, hey, guys, you know, your job isn't done. You need to go out and tell your story and tell folks not just what you did in the military, but why you did it. Because I think it's important for the next generation to hear that so that they have that same and continue that same propensity to serve and that their predecessors and their family members did.
You all have both mentioned the police record. Is it any police record that disqualifies someone, or are certain convictions? What is a disqualifier?
Well, there isn't anything specific. A lot of it is, and some things are waivable, and it changes all the time. But a lot of times, when they start running in with the law, then you start getting other issues that are involved. Drug use, et cetera, that once those things start piling on can affect the ability of somebody to serve.
Okay, so it's not one stupid mistake as a teenager.
No, one stupid mistake is not going to keep you out of the military.
All right. Well, General Bill Libby, thank you so much for calling in and joining our conversation. It's always so great to hear your voice. We are speaking with the current Commissioner of the Department of Defense, Veterans and Emergency Management, Major General Douglas Farnham. Please join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
On January 23, 1945, the Maine State Grange, Patrons of Husbandry, was incorporated as a nonprofit corporation. The Grange, officially known as the Patrons of Husbandry, was organized in Washington, D.C. in 1867. It grew slowly during its early years, but arrived in Maine by 1873. The following year, the Maine State Grange was organized in Lewiston. In 1945, the Maine State Grange purchased a state headquarters at 146 State Street in Augusta.
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of DN Wealth Advisors and the Maine Seacoast Mission. Happy birthday, Maine!
On the next Speaking in Maine, the health of the world's oceans.
When you come from a different country and a different culture, you look at things differently, and we want those different perspectives because that's how you get the best science.
Dr. Deborah Bronk is president and CEO of the Bigelow Laboratory for Ocean Sciences. She spoke at the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations in Rockport about how climate change is impacting the world's oceans. That's coming up on Speaking in Maine Thursday afternoon at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, I'm talking with Commissioner of the Department of Defense, Veterans, and Emergency Management, General Douglas Farnham. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. General Farnham, for those people who are not that familiar with the Guard and maybe haven't been a member, Tell us about some of the units. I think a lot of people are familiar with the 133rd, the engineers who are deployed all the time, it seems, and can build anything in any part of the world. But they are just one unit. I mean, you, for example, were part of probably the most glamorous unit.
The Maniacs.
The Maniacs, that's right. So tell us about the Maniacs.
Okay, the thanks, Jeremy. The Maniacs, you know, near and dear to my heart. I came back off active duty and started flying with them back in 1991. But we the 101st up in Bangor, we have 10 KC-135 aircraft, and basically all over the world we provide air refueling support, which is a critical part of our Air Force, is providing air refueling, whether it be for fighters, bombers. It is a our military, our Air Force would not be the Air Force it is without air refueling, and to do that out of Bangor has been just a great thing.
And when you say air refueling support, if people have not seen the videos of this, this is you refueling another aircraft in flight.
In flight.
At how many miles per hour?
Depends on the airplane, but usually, you know, pretty, you know, 400 miles an hour or so in that airplane. I haven't flown for 4 years, so I don't have the numbers right on the top of my head. They don't let me fly anymore, but it's a, but you're around 400 miles an hour and you're refueling other airplanes, and it's remarkably safe, and because we got guys that are, you know, well trained and take it very seriously.
It must be a thrill every time, though.
Oh, it's a great mission. I often said before I had this job, when I was the wing commander in Bangor, that, you know, being the wing commander of a KC-135 unit in your hometown, it just doesn't get any better than that. And I pretty much hold to that still to this day.
You'd rather have that job than this job?
Well, I like this job. This job is great too, but I don't get to fly. So,
okay, tell us about some of the other units. The unit that's currently deployed in Poland, or 69 of the members, on a day-to-day basis, what are they trained for? What kind of work are they doing?
Well, basically, you know, they do a lot. What the Army Guard does a lot of, besides the engineers, there's a lot of logistics involved. Of course, they've got the Army Aviation, the helicopters up in Bangor as well. They have some infantry, truck company, you know, and this, and the difference between, you know, on the air side, basically the majority of our folks are in Bangor, and all the support for the flying is there in Bangor. We do have the separated unit down in South Portland that's all communications, which is really some amazing stuff as well. But the Army Guard is spread out more across the state, you know, from up in the county all the way down, you know, to southern Maine. So so there, it is spread out a little bit more. And there are some different, you know, the, you know, military police is another very popular career field that folks do. And the engineers are the ones that get a lot of the glory. They're kind of like the Maniacs, I guess, of the Army Guard. They've got a lineage that that they're very proud of. But there are a lot of different opportunities in the Army Guard, and a lot of them you know, dovetail a lot better into being able to provide support in the community for, you know, in that case where there's some sort of natural disaster or man-made disaster when the Guard has to come out and help.
You mentioned that you were active duty before you were in the Guard. Is that usual? Or do many people leave active duty and then join the Guard in their home state?
It's both. I mean, we have a lot of folks that join right here in the state, and have never done anything but Guard. But we do get a lot of folks off active duty. And one of the things we talk, you know, when we're talking about whether it be veterans, whether it be talking about the Guard, and how it meshes with the state, and we now the governor's talking a lot about workforce development, the Guard being in Maine and giving our folks the opportunity to serve active duty, to want to come home, but still not be quite done serving yet. The Guard is a great opportunity for folks to come home. You know, they can be, you know, work in the civilian workforce and also be in the Guard and still put that uniform on, which, you know, when you spend a little time active duty, it takes a while to decide that you don't really want to do that anymore. And you don't have to make the choice if you come home and join the Guard. So that is a very common thing, and we want more people to do it, actually.
You were talking about the off mic during the break, talking about the economic impact of the Guard. I never thought of it that way. I always thought of it as, you know, the National Guard is here to help protect us,
right.
But there's a whole different way in which you believe there's a benefit to the state of
Maine.
Oh,
absolutely. I mean, we, you know, we have about 3,200 members, Army and Air. 800 of those, a lot of people forget, 800 of them are full-time in the Guard. The rest of them are the traditional part-time folks that are balancing work, family, and their military, but 800 are full-time. And we have our federal payroll is about $120, $130 million on the Air and Army side. You add into that another $30, $40 million of federal money that comes in for contracts and supplies and that type of thing, paying for our training. It's about $170 million bucks, and there's only $3 million of it is out of the general fund to fund our National Guard. So that's a pretty good return on investment and for the state.
Going back to talking about emergency management, when Darren called in, Darren Woods from Aroostook County, he mentioned his concern about a reduction of federal funding. Do you share that concern, and do you see that as likely?
Well, it is one of the things that comes up every year or so when they're working on the budget. And I know we engage with the congressional delegation to tell them how important it is. Part of it is an effort to make sure that at every level, from the community to the state, before you get to the federal government, that have a little skin in the game and make sure that everybody is not just relying on the federal grant money to do that. But every year, everybody understands that the challenges in emergency management are so much greater than they were just, 15, 20 years ago. You mentioned cyber and the terrorism piece that requires efforts that not every state and community can fund. So we had the big increase in federal funding, and now they try to find that right number. And so the message that we continue to tell at the state level, and I know that Darren continues to tell them at the county level, his commissioners, that this isn't going to be 100% always federally funded. We do need to decide what the balance is and what the right amount of our local county and state contribution is to have a little skin in that game.
I imagine it's sometimes a hard story to tell that we need money to plan for something that might potentially happen someday.
Well, it's very easy for somebody to look at it and say, hey, what are the chances that that's going to happen? And that's like insurance. I mean, it is difficult to make that decision sometimes, but you're sure glad you made that preparation before. And I know that's one of the efforts that MEMA does. Susan Falloon, you may know, she's a great spokesman for MEMA, and she's constantly out there telling that story about personal resiliency and preparedness because that is so much of it.
Former Governor Angus King, now Senator King, talks about when he was a young governor, he looked at MEMA as a potential place to cost cut. He said he was always looking for those dollars to save, and his thinking on MEMA changed a great deal after the big ice storm. Went from thinking it was possibly a bit of an expendable agency to perhaps the most important agency in state government.
Absolutely, and it's exactly what we talked about. It looks like an easy target, but when you need it, you need it. And I know that the ice storm had that impact on him, because every time I see him, he wants me to make sure I say hello to Earl Adams, because he got to work so closely with the Adjutant General during that time.
Let me ask you about, we talked about cybersecurity being sort of a new frontier, and one I know that you try to come up with scenarios to plan for what might happen, what would we do, how would we respond. I'm wondering how climate change fits into your planning. Is that something that changes the potential scenarios that Maine sees?
Well, it does, and right now the governor has that task force on climate change, and we have some folks at emergency management that are working hand-in-hand on some of those committees, because really it does come into what we talked about earlier, the preparation and the mitigation. There are decisions that you can make when you're doing construction, when you're building roads, that can make your recovery easier. And so there's no question that planning, which is really a big part of emergency management, is the planning. Climate change affects that.
So what you're looking at is potentially, for example, roads that might be underwater in the next ice storm.
Right. Well, the road that may go underwater, and one of the interesting things about it is that when a road gets washed out and then you go to reconstruct and FEMA comes in and there's money involved from federal government, the state government, local, everybody pitches in, and now they say, let's build that road. Well, are we going to build it exactly the same way we built it before, or are we going to do something different so that the next time this storm happens, we don't end up in the exact same boat? And I think there's probably a lot of times that everybody thinks we're just going to go back to exactly the way it was, where we really need to think ahead and say, if, in fact, this may happen again, or it may happen more often, which some people have that opinion, we ought to do something different now as we rebuild to mitigate the future.
As we watch what's going on in Australia with these terrible fires, how big of a concern is that for us here in Maine?
It is still one of the things that shows up on the radar when we start looking at what the biggest threats would be. It's still there. It's been a long time since we had anything serious, but you don't have to go that far away up into Quebec a few years ago having some serious fires. So it is still something that we talk about.
And how about looking at what's happening in China, potential for some sort of disease to spread in Maine? I mean, there's this going on right now, but we've also got, the history in the past few years of Ebola and,
sure.
and the, what was it called, the potential pandemic flu from the H1N1,
right.
I think it was.
Well, interestingly, I think it was last fall, we did a little exercise that was a combination of Maine CDC, Emergency
oh, really?
Management, and the National Guard, and they pulled out some of the pandemic plans just to, basically talk about them and, here's the plan, let the people see each other, just like you would exercise anything else, and that's the one they pulled out because, again, it's one of the things that are on the radar that could be an issue.
General Libby, when he called in, he used the phrase that Maine is a target-rich environment. What did he mean by that?
I thought he was talking about hockey players, but that's I'm not really sure. I think what he was talking about was that as far as the number of folks that are associated with the military and that have some military experience or military affinity and propensity to serve.
Okay, because, I can kind of think on the top of my head, we used to have a nuclear power plant and there's some nuclear material in storage, but...
Yeah, I don't think he was going in that direction.
Okay.
I mean, I that's not high on my list anyway.
Oh my goodness. We're speaking with General Douglas Farnham. His phone number 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. So we don't have a date on when the folks are coming home from Poland.
Don't have a date yet, no.
Okay. But when they do,
we typically will have a little bit of a ceremony and welcome them home. It's always a balancing act. We all get excited and we want to do something special for them, and all they want to do is go be with their family. So trying to have the right balance of an event with recognizing what they want to do is interesting.
Well, let me wrap up with this question, whether it's members of the Guard or the active duty military as family members, as neighbors, come home from serving in Iraq and Afghanistan and other places around the world. What is your advice for those of us here already? What do our veterans and our active duty military personnel want to see when they come home? What kind of experience do they want to have? How can we be good neighbors to them?
I think the first thing is, thank them for what they did, and the other thing is not to just assume that there's something wrong with them now. The vast majority of folks that come back were there because they wanted to be there. They did things that they thought were meaningful. They're proud of what they did, and if there's anything, the biggest struggle is all of a sudden you're home and you don't feel like what you're doing is as impactful as what you were doing when you were deployed. So. So really, I mean, just appreciating the fact they were there, seeing how they need help. If you do notice that they need help, make sure that they understand that there is so much help out there. And the biggest problem is not that there isn't enough help, is people not knowing to reach out or being willing to reach out, so they sometimes need to be pushed. But again, the vast majority of them are not broken. They're not victims. They come back and they are going to be a better member of the community than they ever were before they left.
We were lucky enough to have Travis Mills on the program a couple of times, and when I asked him what folks can do, he said, vote.
Okay.
But I think his point was, we've been defending your right to vote, so darn it, vote.
Absolutely. And just be a part of the community, because that's, you look around and the people that have started businesses and that are the coaches and teachers and legislators and city council members and school board members, a lot of more veterans, and they are key parts of the community, and they always have been and they always will be.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us. That is Major General Douglas Farnham. He's Commissioner for the Department of Defense, Veterans, and Emergency Management. Has been doing that since 2016, was reappointed by Governor Mills in 2019. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as helpful links and resources at mainecalling.org. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Just a reminder that Maine Public is airing the impeachment trial over the air, but you can continue to listen to our regular programming, the Public Affairs Hour at 2 o'clock, the World at 3 o'clock, by going to our website at mainepublic.org. That will be the case as long as this impeachment trial goes on. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.